Today is June 26, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 32 to 34 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's drone campaign, now confirmed at 820,000 hits in 2025 and responsible for up to 80% of Russian battlefield losses, alongside Russia's first economic contraction since 2022. NATO members broadly agreeing to raise defense spending to 5% of GDP, and a UN commission documenting the killing of more than 20,000 Palestinian children since October 7, 2023. Let's begin with Ukraine, and specifically with a number that, on its own, illustrates just how fundamentally this war has been transformed. 820,000. That is the number of confirmed hits Ukrainian strike and bomber drones conducted during 2025, according to Mykhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation. More than 80% of all Russian targets destroyed that year were attributed to drones, and the overwhelming majority of those drones were domestically built. This is not a supplementary capability anymore. It is the primary mechanism of destruction on this battlefield. To understand what that number means operationally, consider the human infrastructure behind it. Approximately 80,000 Ukrainian service members are involved in drone operations in some form, according to official Ukrainian military statements. Of those, somewhere between 25,000 and 40,000 are estimated to be active combat pilots, though the precise figure remains classified. Ukraine's dedicated unmanned systems forces, known as the SBS, numbered around 15,000 personnel as of early 2026, and that force now operates inside more than 100 maneuver brigades and close to 500 separate battalions and regiments. That is not a niche unit. That is a service branch woven through the entire fighting force. The lethality data is stark. The SBS commander's tracking system recorded more than 156,000 Russian soldiers killed or wounded by drones alone during the 5 months between December 2025 and April 2026. Ukrainian sources have obvious incentive to emphasize their successes, and that caveat is worth holding, but analysts at multiple external institutions have reached similar ranges. Poland's OSW Research Institute, in an assessment published in October 2025, concluded that roughly 70 to 80% of Russian losses and close to 85% of destroyed frontline equipment were attributable to unmanned systems. A drone kill zone now extends approximately 20 kilometers behind the front line. That is not a battlefield strip. That is a deep buffer in which movement, logistics, and command activity are all under persistent, lethal threat. Ukraine's industrial base is scaling to match that operational demand. Deputy Minister of Defense Serhiy Boyev stated that Ukraine has capacity to produce more than 7 million FPV drones in 2026, described as nearly quadruple its 2024 output. More than 160 companies are now building FPV drones inside Ukraine. Long-range strike drones have reached targets more than 1,500 kilometers inside Russia, and Ukraine regularly conducts strikes at 600 kilometers. One model developed by a company called Firepoint, the FP5, is reported to have a range of 3,000 kilometers. Professor Michael Clark of Sky News, a professor of defense studies who appeared in our source materials, described the FP5, also referred to as the Flamingo, as capable of flying beneath Russian radar coverage, and said it compares favorably to the British Storm Shadow and French Scalp in terms of range. He noted it has less radar stealth than those Western systems, but at 3,000 kilometers of range, that distinction may matter less than it once would have. Training infrastructure is keeping pace with production. Drone manufacturer Skyfall reported that between 2023 and 2026, its flight schools trained more than 20,000 operators, with the entire program financed by the company itself. The military-run 239th Center of Unit Training maintains an instructor-to-student ratio of approximately 1 to 10. Course lengths vary by role: 39 days for a basic Mavic qualification, 40 to 45 days for the Vampire heavy bomber drone, and close to 2 months for a full FPV combat qualification. That pipeline, company-funded training feeding into a military system, is one of the less discussed structural advantages Ukraine has built. On international cooperation, Denmark became the first country to fund Ukrainian weapons production, doing so in 2024. Following a defense agreement reached in July 2025, Ukraine launched its first joint drone production line in Denmark in September 2025. Germany, the United Kingdom, Romania, and France have each separately initiated drone manufacturing or cooperation projects with Ukraine. The defensive dimension of drone warfare is also expanding rapidly. By late May 2026, interceptor drones accounted for roughly 30% of all Russian aerial threats shot down by Ukraine. To appreciate the scale of what Ukraine is intercepting, Russia launched 8,160 Shahed drones at Ukraine in May 2026 alone, with some attacks involving as many as 800 drones in a single wave. The Shahed is an Iranian-designed loitering munition that Russia has been manufacturing domestically. 8,000 in 1 month, at wave sizes of 800, is an aerial assault sustained at industrial tempo. The fact that Ukraine is intercepting a meaningful fraction of those with its own drones, rather than expensive surface-to-air missiles, reflects a deliberate and economically rational adaptation. Beyond the immediate front line, Ukraine is pursuing a strategic air campaign against Russian infrastructure that analysts assess is beginning to generate tangible economic effects inside Russia itself. Professor Clark assessed that Ukrainian strikes on rear logistics areas up to 150 kilometers behind the front line have disrupted Russian supply chains, with Russian soldiers reportedly going without supplies for extended periods. He stated that Russia's domestic petroleum production has fallen by 25% compared to the same period the prior year, attributing Ukraine's strategic air offensive, including drone strikes on oil refinery infrastructure, as a contributing factor. Clark referenced a Moscow area refinery, identified during the interview as the Kapotnya facility, as expected to remain offline for at least 6 months following Ukrainian drone strikes. Anders Aslund, identified as an analyst with the Stockholm Center for East European Studies and the European Policy Institute in Kyiv, described a shift that is worth pausing on. He said that in the roughly 2 weeks before his interview, Ukrainian strikes on Russian energy infrastructure had moved beyond producing notable imagery to generating tangible economic consequences, rising gasoline prices, and fuel shortages affecting millions of Russian citizens. Aslan noted that observers had previously argued Russian energy infrastructure possessed sufficient redundancy to withstand such attacks, but said that assessment now appears to require revision. The redundancy argument, that Russia's vast energy network was too distributed to be meaningfully degraded, has been a persistent reason for skepticism about Ukraine's strategic campaign. Aslund is saying that skepticism is no longer well supported by what is actually happening. A separate military analysis described a Ukrainian strike on a facility in Orenburg, a gas processing plant, that it characterized as processing 45 billion cubic meters, roughly 1.6 trillion cubic feet, of gas annually, handling 60% of a referenced gas operation's total volume, and producing approximately 123 million cubic meters of output per day. The same facility was described as the source of helium for all of Russia, and as accounting for approximately 80% of Russia's ethane production. These are substantial figures if accurate. The briefing desk notes that the specific production numbers are not attributed to a named energy agency, company, or news organization in the source transcript, so treat them as analyst estimates rather than confirmed industry data. On the Crimean front, Clark assessed that Ukraine has rendered Sevastopol non-viable for the Russian Black Sea Fleet and degraded airbases in Crimea, including disabling Russia's ability to operate long-range strategic bombers or AWACS aircraft from the peninsula. He noted Ukraine has struck the Kerch Bridge 3 times, described the R-280 Novorossiya highway as barely viable as a logistics corridor, and assessed that fuel rationing in Crimea has reached the point where civilian access has been cut, with supply reserved for government agencies and the Russian military. Clark assessed Crimea had not yet been fully isolated, but said Ukraine was close to that threshold. The Security Service of Ukraine has separately reported to have destroyed 2 S-400 weapons units and 2 Pantsir S-1 systems in occupied Crimea, and struck four aircraft hangars at the Saki Air Base. Russia's official response to those specific claims is not reflected in our source materials. On a separate political front, President Zelensky issued a one-week ultimatum to Belarus, with a deadline of June 26, today, to remove or disable Russian signal stations near the Ukraine-Belarus border that have been used to guide drone strikes on northern Ukraine. Zelensky subsequently stated Belarus had complied and disabled the relevant systems. Aslan said the principal issue is Belarusian territory being used to support Russian drone and missile operations, and that Ukraine would be fully justified in attacking such installations. He offered an important political framing. If Belarus committed its own troops to the conflict, the domestic social contract, underpinning the Lukashenko government, which he characterized as an exchange of political unfreedom for peace, would be broken, potentially destabilizing the regime. He noted that large protests had already occurred in 2020, and that sending Belarusian soldiers to die in a war that most Belarusians do not support would carry significant political risk for Lukashenko. Russia's economy is now contracting under the combined weight of wartime spending, international sanctions, demographic depletion, and Ukraine's escalating infrastructure campaign. And the convergence of those pressures is beginning to generate commentary from named Russian sources that is unusually candid. Here is the trajectory. Russia's GDP grew at 4.1% in 2023, then 4.3% in 2024. Growth declined sharply through 2025, and in the first quarter of 2026, Russia's economy posted its first contraction since 2022. More than 200,000 small and medium-sized businesses closed across Russia in the first 3 months of 2026 alone. Experts quoted in the source reporting expect additional closures in subsequent months. Russia's budget deficit is forecast to reach up to 3 trillion rubles, approximately $36 billion, by the end of 2026. Anton Tabak, the chief economist at Expert RA, described by the reporting as Russia's oldest credit rating agency, put it this way, quote, "The economy hasn't cooled, it's frozen. Many sectors are already chattering their teeth." The Russian central bank was more formal, but no less stark. It warned that a recession is, quote, "an almost imminent reality," with some analysts believing it could begin by the end of this year. Central bank governor Elvira Nabiulina, speaking to the Moscow Exchange, described labor shortages as one of the critical factors undermining the nation's economy, pointing to rising wages and subsequently rising prices as consequences of employers competing for a diminished pool of workers. The central bank has raised interest rates to 14.5% in response. The military spending numbers explain a great deal. Russia's military expenditure reached 15.5 trillion rubles, approximately $190 billion in 2025, with 2026 spending projected at approximately 14.9 trillion rubles. Both figures represent 40% of the total federal budget. State Duma Representative Renat Suleimanov, who represents a Siberian constituency, stated plainly that, quote, "The economy can't withstand a prolonged continuation of the special operations mission," and said that 40% of the federal budget devoted to defense and security left insufficient funds for development or capital expenditure. That is a sitting Russian legislator saying in public what the data supports. At the 2026 St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, the candor continued. Kremlin official Maxim Oreshkin stated that Western sanctions should not be expected to be lifted and that a return to prior economic conditions with the West was unlikely, a notable departure from the public optimism that has historically characterized such forums. Roman Trutsenko, founder of Aon Corporation, said the country's business environment, quote, "is doing poorly," and that, quote, "the old model, which worked for many years, has stopped working." Alexei Mordashov, described as Russia's richest businessman, stated his company Severstal had reduced its investment portfolio by 24% and slipped into negative cash flow. President Putin, also addressing the forum, stated Russia was growing at the same rate as major European nations and attributed economic difficulties to state officials rather than war-related policies. There is a telling juxtaposition worth noting here. Russia's unemployment rate stood at 2.1%, a figure Putin cited publicly on April 15th as evidence of economic stability. The following day, Central Bank Governor Nabiulina characterized the same number as a symptom of labor shortages rather than economic health. A 2.1% unemployment rate in a country that is recruiting approximately 30,000 new soldiers per month, that has lost well over 1 million soldiers killed or wounded, and from which more than 1 million Russian nationals have voluntarily emigrated alongside more than 1 million migrant workers, primarily from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, is not evidence of a healthy labor market. It is evidence of a depleted one. Professor Clark, speaking on Sky News, was quoted as saying Putin, quote, does nothing on the domestic front anymore and is, quote, obsessed with the war. Clark separately expressed concern that European political cohesion on sanctions was weakening at precisely the moment when tightened sanctions would have maximum effect on the Russian economy. Asland went further, describing the potential outcome of continued infrastructure strikes, particularly on refineries, oil storage facilities, and pipelines, as capable of bringing Russia back to conditions of the 1990s, though he acknowledged Chinese adaptation or Russian resilience could limit those effects. Given the battlefield and economic picture, where do ceasefire prospects stand? Professor Clark assessed a ceasefire within the next 12 months as a foreseeable outcome, conditional on Ukraine sustaining its current strategic pressure and external political support being maintained. He noted that statements from Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov indicate Moscow has not expressed openness to ceasefire negotiations. Clark also observed that Putin made no public statements in response to recent Ukrainian strikes on St. Petersburg and Moscow, characterizing that silence as consistent with Putin's pattern of response to crises. He tends not to acknowledge setbacks publicly. Clark referenced a G7 meeting and a bilateral meeting between President Trump and President Zelensky as having shifted Trump's assessment. The framing, as Clark described it, is that Trump now views Ukraine as not losing the war and believes it is Putin who should be considering a ceasefire. That is a meaningful shift in how the United States frames the situation, regardless of what follows from it. Asland said he considers it possible that fighting could cease by autumn, consistent with a statement attributed in the interview to Zelensky. He added that the situation could change faster than autumn if the economic pressure of infrastructure strikes intensifies. He described Zelensky's core proposal, transforming the current front line into a ceasefire contact line, as potentially viable given current Russian economic pressures, and said, there may be a faction within Moscow that is genuinely concerned about economic and social conditions and could be receptive to such a proposal. He did not name that faction or characterize its influence within the Russian decision-making structure. Asland was clear that sanctions should be increased and military and financial support for Ukraine maintained and expanded. He also said an ultimatum approach toward Russia is not viable, given Russia's status as a nuclear power. On the question of whether Russia might attack a NATO country, Asland assessed that scenario as not the most likely outcome while the Ukraine war is ongoing, on the grounds that it would create a two-front war Russia cannot sustain. But he said, such a scenario becomes more plausible after a ceasefire, when Russian forces are no longer required on the Ukrainian front. That is a long-range risk assessment, not an imminent warning, but it is the kind of structural logic that is shaping European defense planning right now. On Ukraine-Poland relations, Asland noted current tensions centered on Ukrainian commemoration of the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, known as the UPA, and its association with events in Volhynia and Galicia in 1943 and 1944, events that are deeply painful in Polish national memory. He attributed to historian Timothy Snyder the framing that Ukraine's current elevation of UPA symbolism is a product of the ongoing war, a context that does not fully resolve the historical grievance but provides a lens for understanding it. Asland described Poland's exclusion from recent meetings among the leaders of the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and Ukraine as a mistake, noting Poland's status as an economic and military heavyweight, with vital interests in Eastern European security, and suggested the Weimar Triangle format could be extended to include Poland. Ahead of a NATO summit scheduled for July, Secretary General Mark Rutte traveled to Washington to maintain alliance unity and retain United States commitment to the organization. The meeting included an unusual detail worth noting. Rutte presented materials to President Trump at the Oval Office that included charts bearing titles such as Trump Trillion and the Trump 47 Effect, written in gold coloring.
That is not standard diplomatic presentation. It is a deliberate appeal to a particular political sensibility. And Rutte himself acknowledged that Trump's pressure played a major role in pushing allies toward the commitment that emerged. NATO members have broadly agreed to raise defense spending to 5% of GDP by 2035. That figure is described in the source reporting as more than double the alliance's previous 2% target. The shift from 2% to 5%, if sustained, would represent the most significant increase in collective NATO defense investment since the Cold War. It is worth noting that the source transcript contains a discrepancy. One passage states the target year is 2035, while another states 2045. The transcript does not reconcile this inconsistency, so the briefing desk is reporting the figure most frequently referenced in the cited material, which is 2035, while flagging the discrepancy. Trump, in remarks cited in the reporting, stated, quote, "I just want their loyalty. We don't need their money. We don't need anything. We have the most powerful military in the world, by far." He separately noted that the United States maintains approximately 50,000 troops in Germany, and criticized Italy, Germany, France, and Britain by name for what he described as insufficient support to the United States following a recent Iran conflict referenced in the transcript. On the internal cohesion of the alliance, Clark offered a sober assessment. He stated that the United Kingdom is not prepared for war with Russia and described a defense policy crisis in Britain that he characterized as both political and economic in nature. Prime Minister Keir Starmer's inability to fund defense at required levels is cited as a proximate cause of a loss of confidence within his own party and among the public. Clark assessed that northern NATO members, including the Baltic states, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands, Canada, Iceland, and the United Kingdom, are actively preparing for the possibility of conflict with Russia. Southern and southeastern NATO members, including Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Balkan states, do not share the same level of awareness or urgency. That is not a new observation about NATO's internal divisions, but it is a division that becomes operationally significant if the alliance ever needs to respond to a crisis in the East. The UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory has released a 100-page report detailing the condition of Palestinian children since the outbreak of the conflict on the 7th of October 2023. The commission is chaired by Srinivasan Muralidhar, described in the reporting as a former Chief Justice of the Odisha High Court. The scale of the documented harm is extensive. According to the commission's findings, more than 20,000 children were killed, and more than 44,000 children were injured between the 7th of October 2023 and the 7th of October 2025. Children constituted approximately 30% of all those killed in the occupied Palestinian territory during that period. The commission further documented 151 child deaths attributed to malnutrition, more than 1,000 instances of children undergoing amputation of one or more limbs, and an estimated 58,554 children who lost one or both parents over the 2-year period. The commission stated it found what it described as indisputable evidence of the deliberate targeted killing of Palestinian children, including killings that occurred after an October 2025 ceasefire. The report also documents the use of torture, inhumane and degrading treatment, sexual and gender-based violence against Palestinian children, and the targeting of critical infrastructure including orphanages, healthcare facilities, and educational institutions. Building on that, the report also highlights abuses by Hamas directed at Palestinians in Gaza, a dimension that distinguishes this report from documentation focused solely on Israeli military conduct. The cited reporting does not include a response from Israeli authorities to the commission's findings, and does not identify which body or bodies may exercise accountability jurisdiction. A policy discussion in our source materials examined both the record of the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran and the current state of nuclear diplomacy, drawing on named analysts. On the JCPOA's compliance record, one participant described a pattern of actions that tested the agreement's limits. In 2016, Iran exceeded the heavy water cap twice, with violations subsequently rectified. Between 2016 and 2017, Iran tested advanced IR-6 and IR-8 centrifuge rotors at rates critics said pushed the boundaries of permissible research. Those centrifuges are described as capable of producing uranium 10 to 16 times faster than the IR-1 centrifuges the deal permitted. Between 2015 and 2017, German intelligence documented 32 attempted illegal procurements of specialized metals, electronics, and scientific knowledge within Germany, assessed with high likelihood as intended for Iran's ballistic missile program and latent nuclear development. The IAEA's stated position, as characterized in the transcript, is that Iran did not breach the agreement. One analyst countered that the IAEA's compliance finding applied only to sites within the inspection regime, and that military facilities, including Parchin, were not on the inspection list under the terms of the deal. The transcript notes that the JCPOA did not address Iran's ballistic missile program, a persistent structural criticism of that agreement. On current negotiations, one analyst expressed concern that an emerging memorandum of understanding could replicate the structure of the JCPOA by deferring rather than resolving the nuclear question. That analyst did contrast the current framework with the JCPOA on several points. The current framework would not permit enrichment, would lead to destruction of stockpiled enriched material, and would provide no financial transfer to Iran. Those are meaningful structural differences. Regarding recent military strikes on Iranian nuclear infrastructure, one analyst stated that bomb damage assessments remain limited in specificity. Some credible evidence suggests Iran retains possibly two-thirds of its missile stockpiles and launchers. The analyst characterized strikes as appearing to have collapsed tunnel entrances rather than destroyed underground facilities, and assessed that U.S. administration statements that Iran's nuclear program had been obliterated and its military decimated were unsupported by available evidence. The analyst noted that Iran retains the capability to affect freedom of navigation in the relevant strait, a reference to the Strait of Hormuz, pointing to ongoing discussions about opening the strait as evidence that U.S. control there is not established. A Truth Social post cited in our sources indicated that the U.S. Senate reversed course on an unspecified measure related to presidential war powers regarding Iran, by a 50-47 vote. President Trump credited Senators John Thune, Lindsey Graham, and Bernie Moreno and stated the vote, in his words, puts Iran on notice. The formal legislative title and subject matter of the measure are not clarified in the source transcript beyond that connection to presidential war powers. On the domestic U.S. political front, President Trump announced the cancellation of a planned housing bill signing event, conditioning his support for the 21st Century Road to Housing package on Senate passage of the Safeguarding American Voter Eligibility Act, known as the SAVE Act. Trump posted on Truth Social, quote, "Today's housing news conference and signing is hereby canceled until such time as we pass the desperately needed Save America Act, which I consider to be a national emergency." The housing legislation had passed both chambers with what the Fox report described as overwhelming bipartisan support, making the decision to withhold the signing a deliberate political lever rather than a legislative failure. Senator John Cornyn, responding to questions, acknowledged Trump held a lot of sway but said that if the solution required eliminating the filibuster, the votes simply weren't there, adding, "At some point, we've got to deal with reality." Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville stated the SAVE Act was the number one thing that people want, and expressed support for Trump's decision to withhold the housing signing. In New York's congressional primaries, all three candidates endorsed by New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani won their races. One candidate defeated a preferred successor of a retiring congresswoman. Another narrowly defeated a sitting member of Congress. A third, described as a doctoral student and first-time activist named Claire Valdez, defeated Congressman Dan Goldman. Several winning candidates campaigned in part by highlighting their opponents. Support from pro-Israel donors and ties to AIPAC, described in the reporting as an influential pro-Israel lobbying group. President Trump commented, quote, "When they go more liberal than Dan Goldman, they're really into Never Never Land." House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries is identified as a figure who may face challenges to party unity, with the reporting noting that not all newly elected candidates have committed to supporting Jeffries should Democrats regain control of the House. That is the briefing for June 26, 2026. The throughline across most of these stories is the compounding effect of sustained pressure. Ukrainian drones eroding Russian military capacity at scale. Strategic strikes beginning to erode Russian economic capacity. Sanctions and demographic losses deepening the structural damage. And a NATO alliance recalibrating its commitments against that backdrop. Whether that compounding pressure produces a ceasefire in 12 months or extends the conflict further depends, as Clark and Aslan both noted, on political will in European capitals and Washington as much as on the battlefield itself. This has been your Briefing Desk Geopolitics Update. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.